week of April 21st, 2019, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 445, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. I miss episode 444. Such a nice ring to it.
You missed last week's episode?
Well, just the number. I could listen to it anytime.
Yeah, you could actually subscribe to our podcast and you can download it. You would never miss it.
That's true. And I bet people at Fox missed the old days when they were their own standing company rather than a division of Disney. A lot of people got fired, and now, of course, some projects are falling by the wayside. A lot of things were on hold, really, for like a year leading up to this, but now we're seeing some more casualties. A big one is Fox's Mouse Guard. This was a film long in the works. It's a motion capture film with a lot of big names involved based on a series of graphic novels really popular with kids. It's a fun project, and this movie, Disney pulled the plug 2 weeks before shooting started, so they were just about to begin, and now it's gone into turnaround, and of course, the people behind the project are shopping it around, including Netflix.
Yeah, well, that's kind of, first off, that's very standard. When a film goes into turnaround, the producers get a chance to go and take it elsewhere, usually after a period of time. In this case, the film was about to shoot 2 weeks from now, so that timeline has probably been expedited since Netflix or whoever it is can just pick up where Disney left off. Of course, they'll have to pay the turnaround fee
Of course. Yeah. But I thought it was cute that they said, we're shopping it to Netflix, because there's always a savior in the industry, film or TV. For a while, if your show got canceled, you were always saying, we're shopping it to HBO. You know, we're talking to people, including HBO. PBS was a savior for a while. It pulled out some shows. Oprah is always a savior. You know, there's always a savior that people think and touch as sort of say, we'll talk to them too. And right now that savior is Netflix. Whether you have a TV or a film project, if it gets lost and you want to know, what are you doing with it? Well, we're talking to people, including Netflix.
Well, Netflix is also where you could, you know, I was there last year at Coachella when Beyonce took the stage and did her performance. But now, Michael, you can be there too, thanks to Netflix, because Beyonce released her documentary. You want to talk about somebody who's really, really, like, just knows product and how to release product? It's Beyonce. I mean, here she is in between weekend one and weekend two of this year's Coachella, and she's releasing a documentary about her performance from last year's Coachella, reminding everyone how this year's Coachella pales in comparison.
Bae would not like you calling it product.
Well, okay,
you are not going to do well in a meeting if you refer to her passion project as product.
Okay, I'm sorry.
Just a little point there when you're dealing with talent. Yes, she has a 3-picture deal with Netflix, so that was a huge production. She got paid, of course, by Coachella, $8 million. They spent 8 months rehearsing that performance, that 2-weekend performance that she did. So obviously a lot of money went into the production of it. She's made that money back, and now she's going to make some serious coin because she did a 3-picture deal with Netflix, $60 million. The first one is that documentary Homecoming, and she'll have two more. We don't know what shape or form they'll take, but I'm sure Netflix will be happy to have it.
Well, I haven't seen the documentary yet. I do look forward to watching it.
Maybe you're in it.
I could be. Yes, I'll be the guy going, wow, this is actually pretty good. I was going to leave. But that said, when I was watching it, I thought, wow, this thing is choreographed to within a millimeter. I mean, all the camera work was spectacular. Not like Ariana Grande, who just seemed to throw the whole thing together, even though I know that's not true. So Ariana Grande fans, please don't write me. I know that she didn't do that. But I mean, Justin Bieber came out on her second weekend and he lip synced his entire performance to a point where he forgot to raise the microphone to his mouth to lip sync and his voice could still be heard.
Well, that happens. Was he dancing a lot?
Yes, he was.
Well, there you go. That's what happens. That's what happens at Coachella. What's going to happen this week on Showbiz Sandbox?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we've got a lot to talk about, and half of it concerns... Yeah, we've already began talking about it. It concerns Netflix. On Inside Baseball, Michael will boldly suggest they rethink their approach to monetizing TV shows. He sees One Day at a Time as a missed opportunity for Netflix to do what it's never done before... seek more outside revenue. The Cannes Film Festival has announced a lineup with longtime favorites like Ken Loach and Pedro Almodovar, new favorites like Xavier Dolan, and a lot of women. Well, not a lot of women, not 50% women, but, you know, films directed by women. But given how few movies are directed by women, it's a big change on the quasette. Just don't look for any movies from Netflix. Of course, Hollywood has been transfixed by the battle between writers and talent agents. There's no strike, so no TV shows or movies are suddenly grinding to a halt for lack of dialogue. But it's certainly not business as usual. We've got the latest, including lawsuits and, well, there's more lawsuits and a wake-up call for those who think this standoff has dragged into a second week. You know, stop thinking in terms of days or weeks and start thinking in terms of months and perhaps years. There's no way this ends anytime soon. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. Then we pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, The New York Times, you, our listener. And the number one movie around the world is The Curse of La Llorona. Nothing says Happy Easter like a horror film. This movie made $56 million on its opening weekend. It cost $9 million to make. It's the sixth in the Conjuring franchise, and it stars Linda Cardellini, and it's a hit. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, even I heard it was not very good. I haven't seen it, but I've, you know.
Well, no, it didn't get good reviews. Most horror films don't, though, of course, this got better reviews from the audience than it did from critics. And again, it's the sixth in a franchise and going strong. However, the box office overall in North America was quite slow. It was the slowest Easter weekend in like 14 years, back to 2005, I believe. So not a great weekend at the box office. Everybody is holding their breath, waiting for The Avengers, which I will see on Tuesday.
Yeah, I can. Are you seeing the all media screening?
No, I'm seeing an IMAX, a special screening by IMAX.
Okay, because, you know, the whole thing with this film, they actually did the press junket without showing the film.
Yes, you talked about it last week.
I did mention that? Okay, yeah. But yeah, you want to talk about this movie's just going to explode. This is just going to mint money.
Well, of course, yes. And number two around the world is Shazam. Still nothing. $40 million on the weekend, $322 million worldwide, so that has comfortably tripled its budget, and it's still going strong. And number three is Dumbo, Disney's live-action remake of the animated film. I won't call it a classic because I don't love it. $20 million on the weekend, $307 million worldwide. That one is slowing down and will not be a success story. Not a complete disaster, but certainly nothing like what they were hoping for. And number four, yet another superhero film, Captain Marvel. Another $15 million, $1.09 billion. Boy, what a big, big film that is. And number five is Breakthrough. This movie opened overseas, and now it's opening in North America. It's a boy in coma film. Topher Grace, I thought, played the dad. I love Topher Grace. I think he's a good actor. But in fact, he has a secondary role as a local pastor. Oh, Topher, what's going on here? Come on.
Well, he went from playing David Duke to playing a pastor. He had to, like, even it out.
Yeah, he was good in Black Klansman. $14 million on the weekend. It's now at $20 million. This movie cost $14 million to make, so it's probably going to be okay. At number six is After. That's the fan fiction about One Direction that has been spun off into a film. It grossed $12 million on the weekend, $35 million worldwide, and the story on this one remains the fact that overseas it's doing much better than it did in North America. At number seven is Peace Storm, the Hong Kong thriller we talked about before. That's the fourth in a franchise. More letters will follow. Z, S, P, you name it. They're going to go through the whole darn alphabet because this one made $12 million on the weekend and it's at $113 million worldwide. Here's another new film. It's called Kalank. I think the budget might be about $12 million, very expensive by Bollywood standards. It's a period drama about tragic love, as from what I could figure out, and that made its budget on opening weekend, including it was at number 13 in North America, almost broken to the top 10, $1.3 million at the U.S. box office for a Bollywood film. Still, that's been happening for a while now, but that's pretty cool to see. Scrolling down on the charts looking for some new news, there is Lost in Love at number 16. This is a Chinese drama about a womanizing classical musician and a woman who tries to tame him. It had a modest opening weekend of $3.1 million. And then Change of Gangster. This film looks like it's a 2017 Hong Kong film about an actor who gets injured on a set and he wakes up believing he's a triad boss. Obviously, he method acts the way through his character. It seems to have opened now in mainland China where it has made $2.5 million or it never opened up anywhere. I couldn't find any earlier budget figures for the movie. It seems to have come out in 2017, or at least that's when it was first seemed to be released. But it's a little mystery to me. I'm not sure what's going on with this movie. If you know, let us tell us. Call us.
Yeah, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter, @showbizsandbox is our handle. Or you can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox is where you can like our page. You know, I have to say, Michael, I really hate it when I get injured and then I wake up as a triad boss.
Yeah, I know. It's very tiresome.
Yeah.
At number 19 is Penguins. This is from Disney Nature. That's a label from Disney Pictures. They have an annual tradition now. Come Earth Day, they release a new modestly budgeted documentary film. This one probably cost $5 to $10 million because that's what the last four or five films in the series have cost. It's called Penguins. It made $2.3 million over the weekend. It's at about $3 million worldwide. So I guess it opened in Wednesday on some territories. It's doing modestly well. Not a gangbuster. Early on, these movies cost like $40, $50 million, or they were optioning big things like Planet Earth and turning that into a feature film. Now they seem to have said, all right, you know, we've got modest expectations for these. Let's keep the cost down so we can keep doing this every single year. Is it facing competition from the movie, the documentary series on Netflix? Perhaps. You know, people worry about that competition. In this case, that documentary series on Netflix, narrated by Richard Attenborough, has gotten a lot of attention. Maybe people said, let's just stay home and watch that instead.
What is it called? Our World or something like
yes.
that? Our
yeah,
Planet?
It's supposed to be terrific.
And, yeah, my kids started watching it, and they were enthralled. They couldn't turn it off.
Are they now going to join some activist group to help save the planet? Because God knows that's, you know, the big thing about this is that it has a serious major component of talking about climate change and the threats that we face right now. It's not just a little tag at the end saying, oh, some things are endangered. They constantly and repeatedly make links to the food chain, to how this is threatened, everything you're seeing is threatened, and why and how it's all interlinked. Maybe your kids will end up joining Extinction Rebellion or something. That was the climate change group that did all the protests last week in London.
Well, they'll probably do that right after they finish The Office on Netflix.
Right. And another movie I know nothing about. It's from Sony Pictures Entertainment. I think it's called I Leave It When I Want. And it made $2 million over the weekend. It's at almost $4 million. But darned if I could figure out what this movie is. You know, sometimes the box office is mysterious.
Well, it's probably because that's the American title of a film that is... I don't know where that film is. Sony, yeah, where is that film?
Right, it's an English translation, obviously, of a foreign language title. I asked you if you could find any more info about
yeah,
it, but
I saw
you
that.
Do not check your emails.
No, I did, but I couldn't find anything about it, and I probably should have responded saying, I don't know, I'm going to leave it where I want.
I tried to find some trailers on it, but it's not, you know, sometimes movies come out, they're all over the world, obviously, and we just can't figure out what they are. Often, though, they announce the lineup at Cannes, and you do the same thing. You're like, what's this movie? Who directed it? What could it be about? There's a lot less information, but it's still fun to see what's coming to Cannes.
Well, yes, and last week, Thierry Frémaux, the director of Cannes, the head of Cannes, he announced what films will be there, and there are more women will be there. Certainly 12 of the 47 films in the official selection are directed by women.
And four women will be in competition. One of them, I believe, is co-directed by two women, or maybe that's okay. Just in the official selection. So there's a little bit of a confusion in terms of how many films and how many women. One of the movies is co-directed by two women, so that explains a little bit of a disparity in numbers if you've seen different reports. But yeah, four films out of how many? Like 15, 18 in competition?
Yes, yeah. And, you know, he did say, Thierry Frémaux said, hey, the selection is 90% there, meaning that we've announced 90% of the films. We're still waiting to see which films get edited and are done and we can include. And really, let's face it, what he's kind of telegraphing there is... Will Quentin Tarantino finish his next film before or after Cannes? We're hoping it's before.
Right. We know Corey Ida is not going to make the deadline. They were hoping his new film will be ready. Quentin Tarantino is still editing away, and they will keep a slot open for him. There are a lot of familiar faces, as there usually are at Cannes. They're loyal to, you know, they find a director they love or someone that they build up, like Xavier Dolan, and they want to support them. So you have Terrence Malick, Pedro Almodovar, Xavier Dolan, the Dardens, Ken Loach, Werner Herzog, Jim Jarmusch opens the festival with a zombie comedy starring Bill Murray. But I'm very excited by Celine Sciamma, if I'm saying her name right. She's a French director. I loved her debut film, Tomboy. I interviewed her at Cannes. Then she had another very good success with Girlhood. She is there back with Portrait of a Lady on Fire. So it ain't no Henry James novel. She's a lady on fire. So that's interesting to see. One thing we won't see are any films from Netflix.
Yeah, no, again, for the second year in a row, there are no films from Netflix. And, you know, I think they've kind of made themselves clear. They don't want Netflix films. Netflix doesn't want to be a part of the festival. In part, that is because of the French windowing system, which, by the way, was changed at the end of last year and is continuing to change.
It's not changed enough, though.
Yeah, well, correct. So it used to be that if you were in a movie theater, you would have to wait 3 years before you could be on a streaming service. That's now down to about 18 months.
A year and a half.
And that, well, here's the thing. What they're really trying to do is Canal Plus is the kind of homegrown content provider. They're trying to give special treatment to them. And so they're saying, if you can give a certain amount of money towards the French film industry, then that window closes much more rapidly.
What?
Yeah, it's...
What? You're saying it's 18 months unless you give, unless you donate money somewhere?
Yes, and actually, right now Netflix is donating 2% of the money it makes in France back to the CNC, which is the
but
French...
But that gets them to 18 months or that gets them to something smaller?
That's what I'm waiting to find out. I don't know.
Netflix doesn't even release movies in France.
It does not release movies theatrically in France, and that's one of the reasons why.
No, but so you said they donate 2% of money they don't make. You mean 2% of the money they make as a streamer?
Correct.
2% of their net profits go back to the French film industry?
Yeah, but you go figure out what the 2% of the French profits are.
Well, I'm sure they have, but they're donating 2% of their profits back to the French film industry.
Correct.
That seems insane. But that's not gaining them anything.
Not yet. No, I think they're... Remember,
why the hell are they donating money to the French film industry?
Look, I'm not the... I still...
How have I not seen anything about this? Netflix is...
There is a link in the show notes. I've placed a link in the show notes.
Well, you last minute, little Mr. Last Second. They weren't there last night, were they?
Yeah, no, they were. I put them in last night.
That's bizarre. But that still hasn't changed anything. The fact is, if you show a movie in a theater, you have to wait well over a year before you can show it on a streaming service.
Yes, and by the way, if you think we're confused by this, okay, we're not the only ones. The entire industry, except somehow the industry in France, is confused by the French windowing system. There are whole charts and graphs to figure out who gets to release what, when, and what, why.
Well,
anyway. Yeah, but anyway.
Well, I wouldn't say Khan doesn't want Netflix. Terry very much would like to have them be part of the festival.
Yeah, that's
but
true.
But they cannot change French film laws easily or quickly. And until they do, it's sort of at a standstill. The why they can't be out of competition, I don't understand.
But remember, Bong Joon-ho was there with...
Right, but that was before they had the pushback and then said, all right, this is our new rule.
My only point is that this year he's bringing a film to the festival. You mentioned Corrieta's film, Corrieta winning the
Palme d'Or.
Correct. I'm moving on from Netflix since we'll be talking so much about Netflix.
Well, Amazon will be at Cannes, and not only that is it a streaming service, but it'll be there with a TV show. Two episodes of Nicholas Winding Refn's TV series Too Old to Die Young will debut at the film festival, but being Nicholas Winding Refn, he can't do anything normal. Instead of the pilot episode, you're going to see the fourth and fifth episode. Crazy.
Yeah, welcome to the world of Nicholas Winding Refn.
And you, as a journalist trying to see films, they've changed this screening schedule. Not that anyone but journalists care about this, but again, Khan changed their entire system of how they screen movies for no reason. There was no problem. Nothing was going wrong, and yet they completely upended the system. It was a disaster. They've sort of switched it again, but it's going to make nobody happy. They really have created a problem where none existed.
Yeah, so last year or the year before, you know, it had gotten to a point where journalists would see the film at 8:30 in the morning, race out and on social media say, what a horrible movie. Well, then, of course, directors the cast would say...
Said you have to. They could have... Yes, we understand how the world works, but they could have simply... If they didn't want anybody to post a review or do any social media before the film had its world premiere. All they had to say was, you can't do anything until after the movie has premiered.
And
every journalist
would
have followed that. And if they didn't, they'd be kicked out and they'd never come back. So they wouldn't do it. Nobody would post on social media or post a story or review until after the film debuted. That was all they had to do. Instead, they created an elaborate, crazy, stupid, moronic system, and it's made everybody unhappy.
It made people unhappy last year, although it worked fine for me. And this year they said, okay, well...
Well, that's because you're not a journalist who reviews movies on deadline.
Correct. Yeah, I'm not on a deadline.
Right.
Whereas, yeah. This year
but
they
it's
said...
it's annoying. Wasn't it annoying that you couldn't go see the movie in the morning?
Yeah, I mean...
And had to see it the next day and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of a... Yeah, it was not ideal. Let's put it that way.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, this year what they're doing is they're saying, well, some people will get to see it in the morning.
Only
well, great.
TV and radio.
Yeah, here you have
So why are we talking about Con? We still care, right? Con is we care about it because you go and our friends go and I used to go, and it's still perhaps the most important film festival in the world. It sets the tone for streaming. It sets the tone for how you treat journalists. It doesn't set up the season so much for awards, but who cares? If you go to Con, you will see two or three or four of the best films of the year every single year. I guarantee it. If you are good and go to see 20, 30 movies, you will see some of the best films of the year within a 10-day period. And that's why Cannes still matters.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people are saying, well, it's not in the fall, so it doesn't really count for awards. To which I would say, really, because last year alone, you had Black Klansman and won an Academy Award. You had Cold War was nominated for several Academy Awards. And you also had Shoplifters nominated for an Academy Award. So, you know what? It actually kind of does matter.
And we don't care about award season. All we care about is seeing really good movies. And Cannes does that very well. But will there be any movies anymore? The WGA is
still fighting with their talent agents. They're going to stop. Nobody can do anything. Everybody has to stop. Put your pencils down, everybody, because that's it. There's no more movies. There's no more TV shows. We can't give you nice things.
So how are you feeling about this?
I think it's absolutely insane. I think Mary McNamara in the Los Angeles Times, and I should have put a link to it in the show notes, she hit the nail on the head. She was saying, oh, you know, you guys can't negotiate, you know, lawyers and managers can't negotiate. It's against the rules. And it's the whole thing is just absurd.
And the
absurd.
Lawyers say that's not true. That's absolutely not true.
Yeah, it's like, what do you mean? We actually go over the contracts. And when we say, hey, this has to change, that has to change, guess what we're doing? We're negotiating the deal points.
Well, nonetheless, the WGA is suing the talent agencies. The talent agencies are threatening to sue over the WGA using suggesting lawyers and managers can do some of the work that's being done by agents. They said, no, you can't do that. They're going to go back and forth on that. This is going to head to the courts. 92% of writers have fired their agent as of April 18th. More, I'm sure, have followed. Tensions are mounting. Some people tried to say, oh, no lawyers are going to do any work for their clients because they can't help in tasks done by agents. Other lawyers said that's ridiculous, that's absurd, that's not true, here is why. The DGA is taking stock of its deal with agents. However, that may have just been a poorly worded public statement that they released. We have some writers like Tony Kushner explaining why they love their agent, but they fired them. Others like John Robin Bates say they love their agent and they're not firing them. But the vast majority of writers did fire their agents as of 4/18. And what struck me the most is that some people said this has dragged into its second week.
I'm like, yeah, well, it's going to drag into its second month.
This is not ending anytime soon because there's nothing to negotiate. They're saying stop a practice that has been in, you know, part of this industry for decades, for 20, 30 years now. Packaging has been a central part of what agents do. And the WGA is trying to end that. There's not like, well, okay, you can do it sometimes. I mean, that's a huge systemic change to the system. This is going to go through the courts. This is going to be long and drawn out. And movies and TV shows will still get made, which is a danger both for the agents who are under threat of having people say, why am I paying them 10%?
Well, that's the key. What you just said there is the key. And Mary McNamara points that out. She kind of writes about, you know, right now there are agents and the agents think that they are in charge, that they are the employers. But the reality is, It's the writers that are the employers. They're the ones paying the agents. And yes, there are some specific talent agents like a Brian Lord who represent such big talent that they kind of are in charge because they represent
people
like,
want to work with them. Yeah.
Right.
The writers want to be signed by the biggest name. Yeah.
Right. But for the most part, it's writers who are handing over 10% of their income to these agents, effectively paying people to represent them. And the whole crux here, just for those of you who are just joining the industry, is the packaging fees. The agents package television shows, and they get paid for that. They kind of become a profit participant. The writers don't like that. The code of conduct ended, as you mentioned, Michael, April 18th. At that point, the agents weren't willing to say, we will no longer accept packaging fees, or we want to continue packaging projects and bringing it to networks and studios and being a profit participant.
And beyond that, agents are now forming their own production companies, and some of them are planning to go public, which writers feel like creates even bigger conflicts of interest.
Correct. And really what the agents are concerned about is if they cave, if you want to call it caving, if they negotiate on this point with the Writers Guild, then you're going to have the DGA, the SAG, all of these unions will come after them and saying, yeah, me too.
Right. And what's the compromise? They offered 0.8%. You know, less than 1% of the profits from packaging. So, well, what if we give you some of that? Slice that up for you. Do they want 50%? Do they want 90%? Or do writers simply want the practice to stop?
I think they probably just want it to stop.
Right. And they don't believe that they will automatically make more money because of that. But they have said, look, for the last 20 years, there's been an explosion in the industry, all this demand for our work, and yet we are not making more money. The big names make money, yes, but the daily writers who are in writer rooms, they are not making more money than they were 10, 15, 20 years ago. We're not getting our fair share, and we want somebody to fight for us to get that fair share, and clearly right now, it isn't our agent.
Right, because the agent is saying, well, but we got to keep the production costs down on this so that you guys make more money so that we get a profit participation.
And we make more money. Yeah, so people who think this is dragging into a second week, you know, this is going to go on a long time. And partly the reason is it's harder to point to people suffering. A lot of daily writers are going to be hurting because they're not going to be able to get work. It's harder for them to reach out. Their agents do have contacts. However, when a strike, you know you're not making any money. No money's coming in. In this case, business will continue. Things will go on. People will hurt. But it's really hard to point to lost work opportunity. It's not as easy to say, I know what I've lost because it's been 7 weeks since I've had a paycheck. That's not what we're talking about here. So people will lose out on work, especially smaller writers. You know, they won't be in the loop. They don't have an agent, you know, looking for work for them. They may miss out on opportunities, but work will continue to be done. And therefore, I think it's going to be easier for the WGA to hold the line.
And just to kind of, I'm not taking the writer's side here, just to point out what they're saying, and there is some truth to this, they're saying, look, you know, you get more work when we can package, because we can take a writer.
You mean the agents, maybe, you're taking the agent side.
The agent side. Mm-hmm. The agents are saying, when we can package a writer with a director, and sometimes even the on-screen
actors,
talent,
yeah,
we can actually get something done. Whereas if we just took the writer to the studio or the network, they might say, yeah, that's nice, but you know what? We'd have to do a lot of work to put the whole thing together. Forget about it. Never mind. So what the agencies are saying is sometimes this whole packaging thing actually pushes a project through production, or at least to pilot.
Well, you say, hey, we've got a sitcom starring Tim Allen, directed by Jim Burrows, and written by blah, blah, blah. You know, so that's their thing. To me, those are creative decisions. I've never understood why anybody would want their talent agency to package a deal for them. You know, I want to decide who's going to star in the movie, and it's not necessarily someone who happens to be on your roster. I want to be in the game deciding who's going to direct the film, and it's not necessarily whoever you have on your payroll. You know, so those are creative decisions. Who's going to star in your TV show? Why is the agent making that choice?
Well, very often it's the producer who has gone to an agency and said,
"Hey, it works now," but it's not the creatives.
Right, but the producer isn't saying, well, I guess I'm going to have to take Tim Allen because
you
represent
him. Well,
but
they are, because CAA is constantly going to push for their talent, because that's the whole point. They want as many people from the CAA roster to be in that project. Otherwise, they make less money. And they want it to go to a network where they have the best relationship, where they can get the best deal. Never mind if the writer or the director wants to go somewhere else. And that may be a better fit for them long term. So again, those are business decisions overriding creative decisions.
That's never happened before.
Yeah. I don't know. I try to listen to people talking about the agent side. I have always been confused by why packaging was anything anyone would want other than the agents. Why anybody would agree to it other than the agents, I have no idea.
Except they're
so powerful at some points. You know, you have no choice. But to me, it's not a win for the studio. It's not a win for the writer or the director or the actor. It's like you're just bundled together by the agent and say, here you go. Here's our deal. You know, I don't see it.
Well, sometimes the networks like it because they get a whole project ready to go.
It's not hard to find somebody you want to star in a sitcom. If you want to make a project happen, it's not exactly like it's a struggle to find actors willing to line up and audition.
I guess
that's not really hard. You're ABC, you want to put a show on primetime, people are happy to work with you. They'll all thank you, CAA, for dealing with that. That's called their job. I don't know. It's going to be a long haul, though. Maybe we'll get blindsided. Maybe next week this whole thing will blow over and they'll come to some agreement or understanding. But people saying it's dragging into a second week, I'm like, this is not the timeline we're talking about. I don't see any reason why this won't drag out through the courts and through the business for a long time to come.
Well, that would make it kind of a big deal.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, my God. Is it time for Big Deal, Big Whoop?
That's right.
That weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense?
Yes, it is time for that segment.
What's our first story?
Well, our first story is about director Roman Polanski. He wants to be back in the club. He's suing the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences. That's a long mouthful. AMPAS. He's saying they didn't follow their own rules when kicking him out of the organization. Polanski was, of course, dismissed the same day as Bill Cosby and Harvey Weinstein, a comparison Polanski's lawyers scoffed at, by the way. What's one rape from more than 40 years ago? One might imagine the Academy is a private club and can invite or disinvite whomever they want. One might also think the last thing Roman Polanski wants is to have the world discuss in detail the horrible things he has admitted doing. He has actually admitted and went to jail for them. And yet, he's suing. Is this a big deal or big whoop?
I don't understand this at all. Again, who's the winner here other than the lawyer? Why the heck would he want to get into the Academy if he has to sue to do it?
And I don't understand.
I mean, how much pride do you have? Why do you care? And I'm obviously not a lawyer, but I don't understand why a judge wouldn't throw this out before it would even come to trial. It's a private club. They don't want him in it. They can do whatever they want. So, they didn't follow their rules. So what? I just don't see where it becomes a legal issue. But, we'll find out. Maybe it will be dragged out in the courts. It'll be tossed out right away. There must be some legal issue I don't understand because I cannot. And I've read a number of stories trying to figure out what grounds he has to sue. But
I was trying to figure that out, too. I can't figure it out.
Yeah, it makes no sense to me. And even if there are grounds, why the heck you'd want everybody talking about what you did again? I don't see how it helps you in the least.
Well, here is our first out of a trillion Netflix stories. Netflix stock is bouncing up and down like a yo-yo thanks to Disney presenting info on Disney Plus and quarterly reports and Apple's face flop at its own presentation. But the news Netflix can control, well, it's pretty good. It added nearly 10 million subscribers in the first quarter of 2019. Since North America is a mature market, most of those additions came internationally. Worldwide, Netflix is at 149 million subscribers and counting, of course. And now they're at 149 million paid subscribers. There's about 10 trillion people that are sharing the password.
Shame.
It also vowed to be a little more forthcoming about TV ratings in their own endearing way. Netflix saw the just-renewed Umbrella Academy has been sampled by 45 million viewers worldwide. Now, that means 30% of all Netflix subscribers watched a good chunk of at least the first episode. How many watched the entire season? Yeah, no idea. It says the action film Triple Frontier was watched by some 52 million people. Now that means they streamed at least 70% of the film. And since TV networks don't have worldwide figures to offer, it's hard to know how to compare all this to a show's hit status in the US, or even in Europe, or a specific country. Game of Thrones reaches 32 million people on average last year. And that's in North America alone. How many does it reach worldwide? Anyone? Somebody? Anybody? Bueller? No? Okay, well, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop. They continue to add subscribers. It's a little bit of a slower pace. It's happening overseas, but we knew all of that. And the numbers that they release about these shows are both a little opaque, and we have nothing to compare them to. At one point, it's like, $45 million for Umbrella Academy? For God's sakes, that's bigger than Game of Thrones? That makes no sense. However, they're just saying that somebody watched a good chunk of one episode. That's all they're claiming when they say 45 million people did that. Somebody let most of an episode, and I assume it must be the first one. Why would you watch the fourth episode? You know, they watched at least 70% of the first episode. That it would be great to have worldwide figures on TV. Every once in a while, you'd hear something like Baywatch is the most watched TV show in the world, or NCIS is the most watched TV show in the world, and they'd say some crazy figure like 100 million people watch Baywatch every week, you know, back in the day. So, you know, we'd have nothing to compare these to, but it does remind us how much audience there is and how much money to be made worldwide. All those big shows on network TV that have been running for 15 years, NCIS, all their franchises just got renewed, the Law and Orders, the Chicago, those things get played all over the world, and networks never talk to us about how big their audience is or how much money they're making, because they don't want the actors to say, I'd like a raise.
Yeah, well, according to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, and every other network, looking at the balance sheet here, yeah, they're all unprofitable overseas. Baseball loves tradition, but the New York Yankees have just ended one. After 18 years of playing Kate Smith in center field. Oh, wait, no. They were playing Kate Smith's rendition of God Bless America.
She's more of a catcher, I would say.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Well, the team has dumped the recording. Wait, why have they dumped the recording? How? They became aware of other songs the famed singer had recorded during her career, especially a song called That's Why Darkies Were Born. Newspaper articles quoted offensive lyrics. The Yankees put the practice on hold and then announced they would not use the Kate Smith recording ever again. The hockey team, the Philadelphia Flyers, soon followed suit, dropping their practice of playing the recording that had been going on since 1969. And to boot, they're getting rid of a statue of Smith that stood outside their arena. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Oh, God, my head, this story. It's very complicated. It's a lot more complicated than you think. Number one, That's Why Darkies Were Born is not a racist song. It's an anti-racist song. It is literally anti-racist. It was recorded by Paul Robeson and Mildred Bailey, both people of color. Paul Robeson does not sing racist songs. He's not going to cater to anybody. And if you listen to the song or you read all of the lyrics, you'd have to be a moron not to know this is an anti-racist song. So that's the first problem. The second one is, guess what? Every baseball stadium in the country plays Randy Newman. They play the theme song from the film The Natural. You know that music? Da-da, yeah. Da-da-da-da. That has been played 10 gazillion times in baseball stadiums all over the country. Guess what? You better stop playing it, because Randy Newman has sung all sorts of songs with offensive racist lyrics, such as Underneath the Harlem Moon from his album 12 Songs. That's a cover. He also has songs from his entire album, Good Old Boys, that are racist and offensive because he's singing in character as a racist, offensive moron. He is mocking them. He is belittling them. But if you just read the lyrics and are stupid, you will say, oh my God, we can't play Randy Newman anymore.
I mean, this is a guy, Randy Newman, that is, that has a song called Short People Got No Reason to Live.
Which many, many little people were offended by at the time. And they took offense to that. And they did not appreciate the sense that Randy Newman was trying to mock the person. They did not feel the irony that he was presenting there. That certainly, if you look in context of his entire career, you can better understand, oh, this is where he's coming from. He's done this a lot with all these different stories and characters. When you don't know Randy Newman and you just hear the song, you might get offended. That brings us to our next idea. People got very angry and upset. You know, the song, they look at the lyrics, and I'm saying, look, these are anti-racist songs. However, Paul Robeson singing this song is quite different from a white woman, Kate Smith, singing the song. There are songs that Public Enemy can sing that I better not sing in public because it's different when I sing it. Was Kate Smith recognizing the irony of That's Why Darkies Were Born? I'm not so sure. So, you know, I think it was stupid of people not to recognize what kind of song this was. But then they pointed out other things that Kate Smith did, like singing a song called Pickaninny Heaven and endorsing a doll, a mammy doll, back in 1939. And guess what? She came from an era where there was a lot of offensive prejudice and racism. She doesn't seem to be a fire-breathing racist from everything I can read about her life. In fact, though, one of her early breakthroughs was on stage where she was in blackface singing Hallelujah. You know, guess what? That's America, baby. Everything in our culture is intertwined with racism and prejudice. If you know anything about our history, our pop culture, it is inextricable from prejudice and racism. What I wish had happened was that people learned about Kate Smith, learned about the other songs she sang, and in the future, when they heard her singing God Bless America, they could maybe appreciate the song, but they'd also be reminded, yeah, okay, this is a good song, and it was written by a Jew, and it's practically our national anthem. Isn't that cool? However, she also did some other stuff that was really unpleasant. That's the world that she came from. That's the country that we were. And maybe that would remind you, yeah, it's not so simple. You know, don't get so angry and upset. How dare they take this song off the air? Why are you so eager to play a song by a person with that past? But at the very least, maybe this controversy would remind people, yeah, that's our history. You know, wake up, learn yourself, educate about it. And maybe that would be better than trying to erase her and pretend she never happened.
Keep in mind, you know, doctors used to say smoking was good for you.
Yes. We get smarter about medical issues. Yes.
Yeah, meaning
we got smarter on race. Well, yeah. Well, we're not that smart on race yet, but yes, it's a complicated issue, but everything about this was stupid and wrong.
Smart speakers. Unlike the last story, stupid and wrong, we have smart speakers. Who are getting, well, who, listen to me, I've just like turned
you anthropomorphize them.
Yeah. They are getting more and more attention from streaming services. First, YouTube launched YouTube Music, an ad-supported streaming service available via Google smart speakers. Then Amazon launched ad-supported Amazon Music via Alexa. I still can't figure out how to turn that on. More and more people are accessing music via their smart speakers, and the smart streamers want to be there first. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, or have I just set everybody's Amazon Echo devices off?
I was about to say, Alexa, play Amazon Music.
Here's a station you might like. Ultimate Jazz on Amazon Music.
Wait, don't turn it off. We're going to get sued for copyright infringement.
Alexa, stop. Well, how hard was that to do? You said you had trouble doing it?
Oh, I don't know how to. I don't know the words to say.
That's all you have to do. So this is my point. Wow. Smart speakers are in a lot of people's homes. They're a big entry point for music now. And these people are smart to be there. You know, it doesn't seem like a big deal right now. Or they're just on one smart speaker from one service because they YouTube and Google are all, you know, in bed together. It's the same company. Yeah, but that's how people are accessing music more and more, certainly in their homes. So it's a smart place to be. So it doesn't seem like a big deal right now, but it probably will be in the years to come.
You know, wives that I know, they think that these speakers aren't so smart. They would only be smart if they could actually remind their husbands. Yes, we did have that conversation. In fact, here's the playback.
Well, that's coming.
Yeah, I know. Netflix, again, and exhibitors are both learning the art of compromise. Netflix has the new Martin Scorsese gangster flick, The Irishman, which stars Robert De Niro and Al Pacino. Theater owners, of course, would like to exhibit the film, but they need their theatrical window of 90 days respected. Netflix wants to get movies to its subscribers as soon as possible, but wants to keep filmmakers like Scorsese happy, and happy means Oscar potential and a big, noisy theatrical run. As Omar on The Wire once said, "You got to have a code." But codes can be, you know, fiddled with. Netflix is apparently suggesting a theatrical window of 72 days. That's the window when studios are allowed to begin offering theatrical releases for sale as a digital download. They call it early electronic sell-through. Now, 10 weeks is a pretty long time, especially if a movie gets a wide release from the start. Theaters will make money, Scorsese will be happy, and Netflix can at least boast of shaving 18 days off the firm and never changing 90-day window. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, I'm going to ask you, is it a big deal?
I think that last little bit, the fact that Netflix would run around going, yeah, we just shaved 18 days off the window, is the reason this will never happen.
But they're not shaving 18 days off the window, because that's when studios, every time I get a release about a DVD and Blu-ray coming out, the schedule for when it is available as a digital download is in fact 18 days earlier than when it comes out on Blu-ray. So they've been doing, they're doing this already. 72 days is the window for digital downloads. Studios can start selling their movies directly to customers 72 days after it hits the theaters. So Netflix is saying, hey, why not just include streaming in that window?
Right, which is exactly what the movie theaters.
But they're already allowing studios to do it.
No. They're allowing studios to sell. You have to buy the whole movie. Mm-hmm. That is what, by the way, it is a transactional exchange. That is not a subscriptional one, okay?
Okay.
That is exactly what studios want. They want people to buy the film and then, of course, to pay to stream it.
If they buy the film, they don't need to pay to stream it. They buy it outright.
Well, right. But, you know, then Warner Brothers has its service and Disney has its service and
service?
So on.
If you buy it, you own it.
Right, but then if you pay for the service...
What service?
Disney
Plus. You pay $15. No, that's different. That's different.
Right, but that film that you purchase will probably be on Disney Plus.
Care if you purchase it.
Correct. So then you will own it. But
so Disney Plus and Warner Brothers launching streaming services would love to say we can make our movies available on our streaming service 72 days after it comes into theaters. And you're saying that's what they're scared of.
That is correct.
But who cares? If it's 72 days... That it will already be played out. And if it's not played out, won't the studio want to keep it in the theaters? I mean, they're not going to rush it into streaming when they feel like there's still money to be made in the theaters.
Sometimes those things are set and, you know, you have marketing campaigns and...
Oh, a big blockbuster, yeah. But, you know, those tend to play out anyway. They don't run for 6 months usually. It's usually small films that become surprises. Isn't it small films that become surprises? So you're saying this is not going to happen. There's no way exhibitors will agree to this.
It's going to be maybe with a Scorsese film, maybe, but no. It's going to be
the Scorsese is not a big box office draw. Let's be clear about that. I mean, he's a great director. He's made great films, but he is not money in the bank come box office. He ain't Spielberg.
No, you know, but they did spend $200 million on this movie.
Well, and that's why I feel like even if Netflix doesn't get the 72-day window, they need to make some money back on this movie. That's a lot of money. So I think the pressure is on them to actually make some box office revenue because this is a damn expensive movie.
Well, and they're not going to have MoviePass to invite patrons
to shoulder to pour people into the audience and buy their tickets for them.
Right. Well, and we've assumed, by the way, that MoviePass lost a lot of subscribers, but now we've got some numbers to back that up.
Oh, I should be reading this. The trade journal Business Insider reports that it obtained some internal data that shows MoviePass's subscribers dropping from more than 3 million down to 225,000 people. That's a big drop. How many of those simply can't leave because they bought an annual pass isn't known. They also say MoviePass has signed up just 13,000 subscribers since relaunching their Movie a Day offer with some caveats. Apparently, moviegoers said, fool me once, shame on you. MoviePass said the numbers quoted are, quote, incorrect, but they offered no further information to refute it. Cinemia, another movie subscription service, is presumably suffering similar losses ever since it began blocking subscribers from actually using the service the way it was originally promoted. Is this a big deal or big whoop, Michael? I will say it's a big whoop. It's what we expected to know. But I put it in here because I thought it was interesting. It was some firm data, at least from a respected source of Business Insider. However, we have a caveat that, you know, there is a Sperling is associated with other people.
Yes. Convergent, which is the consulting group I work with. Infinity is a subscription network that is presently launching that we help provide guidance to.
It's called Infinity?
Infinity,
right. I already forgot what the name was. Yes. So just to be clear, I saw this story. I thought it was important. I put it in the notes. I wanted to talk about it, but we want to let you know about that conflict of interest in case you thought, oh, we're saying bad news about MoviePass because he's working for a competitor. No, it's just me.
Well, and it's kind of hard to say that there isn't bad news about MoviePass when, you know, CinemaCon was just 2 weeks ago and you had people that once were working for MoviePass, not at MoviePass anymore, walking around trying to find their next job.
That's no good.
At this point, you're stating fact. You're not stating, you know, you're not trying to talk somebody down. Right, I don't know whether
you want to know if it's Warner Brothers talking about Disney, even if they're repeating facts. You want to know it's Warner Brothers talking rather than a disinterested observer.
Yeah, well, and this is what I think is interesting. Jason Guarasio wrote this story in Business Insider, okay? Mm-hmm. He was at CinemaCon. as were some of these former employees of MoviePass, and then all of a sudden there's leaked internal data.
There's also telephones, of course. You could have spoken to them on the phone. But yes, they were in the same room together. And I assume, have you spoken to any of the exhibitors that worked with MoviePass and what their experience was like and whether it was a positive or negative one ultimately or whether they liked it when it was at its peak?
They did like it when it was at its peak because, of course, they were reaping the rewards.
Well, were they? Maybe people weren't buying popcorn or, you know, did it actually work for them well, you know?
It did, actually. That's why now everybody is talking about the subscription model.
All right. Interesting.
Now, let's move on to TikTok, or let's not. I hate TikTok. The wildly popular app TikTok continues to torture parents. Hello, I'm one of them. They also continue to break musical acts and make news. The Chinese app, which allows users to create short videos mixing video and popular music, has been entangled in music rights issues as major labels demand higher royalties before signing a new blanket license agreement. And now it's been banned in India. And in my house. Not for any music rights issues. Instead, a court ordered the app removed from Google Play and the Apple iTunes Store and other stores because it found the app encourages pornography and sexual predators might use it to target children. The court has appointed an independent counsel to deal with the issue, and TikTok expressed support for this move and said in a statement it was sure they'd come to terms and the app would soon be available again to the 120 million active monthly users
in India.
Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big whoop. It's a court battle. It'll pass. It's a suddenly bizarre claim. Oh, you're encouraging porn and sexual predators will use TikTok. Really? I mean, these same things have been said about the telephone and the internet and email and YouTube and you name it. So if there's any bad content on TikTok, obviously they want to make sure it gets off there. But this sounds like a bizarre attempt to make headlines by politicians who've been decrying TikTok and the evil influence it has on children. It sounds like a whole lot of hoo-ha.
Well, you know, I can tell you that TikTok works. And what I mean by that is it does break musical acts because my kids were running around singing that Old Town Road song.
Number one for 3 weeks.
And I said, how do you know that song? They were like, oh, it's on TikTok. I
was like, that's where it broke, baby.
But they said, oh, but we only know that one section. I had, the Amazon Echo, I won't say her name, play the entire song. And they were like, wow, there's a lot of words to this. We only know this one section.
Good. Just a two-minute song too long for them? Oh, Lord.
That's why I hate TikTok.
All songs will be 30 seconds long.
Yeah, well,
let's talk about Netflix. I feel like we haven't spoken about them enough.
We haven't talked about them in, one story? No, two stories. Ooh, that's pretty. We're like on a streak. Amazon turned its back on New York City when the company wasn't welcomed with open arms, despite billions of dollars in tax incentives. Netflix, on the other hand, is doubling down on the Big Apple. It's expanding corporate offices in the city to the tune of 100,000 square feet of space. The 32 New York-based employees will be joined by another 127 highly paid executives. Furthermore, Netflix is building 6 sound stages in Brooklyn, encompassing 161,000 square feet, which will employ thousands of people down the road. Just like Netflix, projects that already filmed in the city, such as Orange is the New Black, The Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt, and the Scorsese film The Irishman, if Netflix keeps the 312 jobs it already has here and adds the 100-plus jobs and keeps them all for, like, say, 5 years, I'm just trying to do the math here. They're going to reap incentives amounting to $4 million. Yes, that's million, not billion. But is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Yeah, million. That's the way it's done, you know? They want to bring jobs, you need more office space, you need a soundstage, mazel tov. Enjoy yourself. That we're happy for you. You know, the city should not be rolling out the red carpet and throwing billions of dollars at them to do this. They're a successful business. They need more space. Great. You want to do business in New York? You should. It's a great city to do business in. Good. So that's the way it should be done. So happy to see that and happy to throw it in their face in terms of how much incentives they were getting. There may be some other tax incentives we don't know about because they're just always on the books. You know, there are state laws that may be giving them tax breaks that they don't necessarily need because they're not a struggling new business or an entrepreneur. They're a massive multinational corporation. So I will put a caveat there that I may not know about all the incentives they're getting, but that's what was reported, and it's good to know.
And I have not done the math on the, you know, $4 million comes from 500 employees over 5 years, right? So, you know, Amazon was saying, well, we're going to employ 50,000 people. And if those 50,000 people were employed for 5 years, well, how much tax revenue would that be? Let's not even go into that. That's too much math for me. Just move on into inside baseball. Inside baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. And then, Michael, I'm going to turn this over to you because, frankly, I don't even know if there's a news story here.
It's not. It's just an idea. I was struck. Disney Plus did their great presentation that everybody thought was terrific. They have Disney. They have Marvel. They have Pixar. They have National Geographic. They have the great catalog of movies and TV shows. And the grand finale of the entire presentation, the last image that they presented to people practically, was not a Disney film, was not a Disney classic or an animated classic or The Lion King or something like that. It was a TV show, wasn't it? And what TV show was it?
I don't even know. Was it Friends or something? What was it?
The Simpsons.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yes, that's right. Because, and of course, now they have it. Yes, that's
now
right.
Now they own The Simpsons, but they ended with The Simpsons. Isn't that fascinating? I mean, to say that this is, you know, this Disney Plus will be the home of The Simpsons. They have 600 episodes. And you know, movies are great. They've got all the Star Wars films. That's 8 movies. You can watch them in like a day. You know, 600 episodes of The Simpsons, that'll keep you busy. And that tells you those iconic TV shows, how valuable they are. And when you have a blockbuster hit like The Simpsons, you're going to want to have that puppy be exclusive, perhaps, to your streaming service. They're still going to let it be syndicated on TV, I believe. But when you're going to go to a streamer, that's where you'll find all of The Simpsons episodes. And so we're hearing about this for other players like Netflix. Friends has 200 episodes. The Office has 200 episodes. Those are huge players for Netflix. Some people say they're their most popular program, more popular than all the original programming that they do. And Netflix is not going to have them forever because the studios behind them are going to want them for their own streaming service. Like Warner Media definitely is going to hold back Friends. And compare that to a Netflix hit like Stranger Things. How many episodes do they have?
17.
17 episodes. Again, you can binge that puppy in a few days.
Why do you keep asking me to do math? There's $4 million, 500 employees, and now you got to this 17 episodes, 200 episodes, $100 million. Too much math.
Yeah. So Seinfeld and The Big Bang Theory are tied up in syndication and different deals, but they're going to come free in 2021, and the studios behind them, again, are going to want to use them to build their streaming services and get people to say, you know what, $7 a month is worth it, or $10 a month is worth it, or $5 a month is worth it. And that brings me back to Netflix. I'm wondering if they can rethink their sitcoms. You know, Netflix has done a great job. They were a company that shipped you DVDs. That was their business. And then they pivoted to create an entire network so they could stream stuff to you. That was a massive change in their company. And they licensed libraries from studios. Then they pivoted again and said, we better make original content because they're going to just keep charging us more and more, or they're going to compete with us and say, you know what? We're going to take Friends back and we won't have it anymore. So it's a lose-lose for us either way. And now they've created so much original content, they're going to be okay standing on their own, even though they still want to have libraries of other studios. But I feel like they missed an opportunity with One Day at a Time. Not that they should have just kept making episodes because it would be more valuable as a streaming, but I feel like they need more revenue streams. They've got movies that they want to play in films, in theaters, like The Irishman. When you pay $200 million for that, I think you want to have a theatrical release just to make some money, don't you? Doesn't that seem like a good idea?
It would seem like a good idea, but then you would be saying the theatrical experience is better than the Netflix experience, and therefore,
I think you're just saying I spent $200 million on a movie. Maybe I should think of different ways to make money off of it. And you know, you think, well, yeah, but they've got their crown jewels. Why would they ever want to release Orange Is the New Black and make it available to other people? Well, that's what HBO did, right? I'm sure people are saying, well, Game of Thrones, they'll never give that away. They'll never let anybody else have that. Well, The Sopranos was the biggest show they ever had. Before that, Sex and the City was the biggest show they ever had. Both of those were syndicated.
Well, I wish that, you know, Netflix would kind of look at it the way Spotify looks at concerts, right? And I get the fact that you're seeing the person live and their person is standing right there. But Spotify has all this music, right? And they have, well, let's take Ariana Grande. They have all of Ariana Grande's tracks. You could just stay home. Why promote the fact that she's coming to a town near you or playing Coachella? You don't want to say that Spotify is the second, you know, is a secondary experience to, say, a live concert.
But they do, right? They do promote concerts.
They do, exactly. So what I'm saying is, why can't Netflix say, hey, look, we've got this big giant film called The Irishman. Everybody should look, it's a big movie. You can see it on this giant screen. Go see it on the giant screen. And oh, by the way, you know,
we're going to have it exclusively.
We're going to have it exclusively. You're not going to be able to see it on Disney Plus. Okay. Yeah. 3 years from now, when you want to watch that movie, it's only on Netflix.
Yeah, I feel like it's a, like you say, going to a concert is a different experience than listening to music, and it's not competition in a way. And frankly, going to see movies in the theater just makes you want to watch more movies at your theater, at your home. We've seen all these services. You make stuff available via VCR or DVD. It doesn't stop people from watching movies. They watch more of them than ever before. It's a much bigger business because movies are available on cable and on demand and streaming and DVD and Blu-ray. And I agree. I just think if you've got a crown jewel, you maybe want to keep it to yourself in it for a long time to come. But when you've got a show like One Day at a Time, this sort of is in a sweet middle spot. It ran for 3 seasons and made 39 episodes. And Netflix said, you know what? It's played out. We're not going to bring more people to our service just by continuing to make more episodes. It's not growing. And, you know, we're just going to pull the plug. It worked. We were happy with it. It brought people to our service. But now its time has ended. And I think that makes sense. However, what if they went another 3 seasons and got enough episodes so that it could strip? And then maybe 5 years from now, when the show was over, they could sell it and let it strip to, you know, TV Land or Nick at Night or all these other channels that need content. You know, they sort of let it fall through the cracks.
You know, they could do that with House of Cards, for instance, or Orange is the New Black. They will never do that. They're never going to linear television.
HBO did it. HBO did it with their biggest hits ever. And here's why they should. Maybe with the biggest hits, they won't do it. But One Day at a Time is not one of their biggest hits. But maybe they said, we've invested X amount of dollars in One Day at a Time. We've already made 40 episodes. If we just make another 40, we'll have enough to strip and sell it off to somebody. We'll still have it as a streamer. But guess what? After 3 seasons of One Day at a Time, 2 years from now, no one is going to subscribe to Netflix because they've got old episodes of One Day at a Time. It's nice to have that library. It's valuable. It's important. But nobody, when they're not making new episodes, no one's going to say, I got to subscribe to Netflix so I can watch 4-year-old episodes of One Day at a Time. It's still a useful thing to have on their service. But maybe there's more money to be made by saying, okay, for this show, because it's 40 episodes, we've already spent all that money, it's popular enough, we believe there's a market to syndicate it and strip it, which means we'll still have it. Nobody's going to feel cheated because, you know, HBO, you know, syndicated The Sopranos. Nobody thought, oh, HBO's no good anymore. There's no point, right? It still worked, but it's also something that hits that sweet spot. It's good enough. You can strip it. You can sell it to someone else. It's still a valuable property. And in fact, it may make people shine on Netflix even more. That's where the show began. I just think they invested so much money in it for 3 seasons and 39 episodes. You've invested tens of millions of dollars. Why not go that extra mile and have a property that you can syndicate and strip? Because there's more money to be made. Why avoid that money revenue stream? It's for your biggest hit, you may not want to do it, even though HBO did. For a show that's a flop, it may not make any sense. But for a show like this, I feel like, you know what? Maybe 100 episodes matters again. There's a lot of cable channels out there, and more big services are holding on to their big guns. You know, they need product. Maybe.
Well, you could say the same thing about House of Cards, or maybe I don't know if that's a bad example now because of the whole Kevin Spacey issue, but Orange is the New Black. They used to offer DVD rentals of that particular series.
That makes sense.
In Redbox. They do not any longer.
Right.
And
well,
yet that's a revenue stream.
The difference with House of Cards and Orange is the New Black is the same difference with HBO's The Sopranos and probably Game of Thrones. They work well because they are adult shows and they can work well. They don't work well in syndication. So much of it had to be bleeped. So much of Sex and the City had to be messed with that it really didn't play well as a syndicated show. What made it special was that adult stuff. Game of Thrones is super violent. There's nudity everywhere. One Day at a Time? Uh-uh. It works fine. There's nothing to change. It's a family-friendly show. It will work in syndication just as well as it worked on Netflix. I don't think that's necessarily true for Orange is the New Black. That's why I think that's a valuable property that can work in syndication. And it's not such a big hit that you want to say, oh, we got to keep it to ourselves. And if it's a flop, nobody cares. But when you've got that, you know, you've hit a double, and you could say, you know what, we've invested how much money on this show? If we just invest a little bit more, we'll have something that we can syndicate. It's money to be made. Just like there's money being made with The Irishman in movie theaters. I know it's a big change. I know it's completely contrary to what they've been doing and everybody's idea of exclusivity. But I think it's money on the table, and why let it slip away?
Well, speaking of slipping away, a few people have slipped away. What is it, that mortal coil?
Yes, this mortal, we've slipped this mortal coil.
Yes, actor Georgia Engel. She died at the age of 70.
Oh, I was saying, you know, I just went, people are on TV shows like Georgia Engel was Georgette on The Mary Tyler Moore Show, most famously. You just go, oh, you know, it's a character that you've known for so long. And this character, the person she played was so sweet and so eccentric and so adorable that you just feel like you like her. And I'm really lucky. I got to see her on stage a few times in recent years. Will Eno's Middletown and Annie Baker's John. Just like she was on the show, just a wonderfully eccentric, odd, unique, sweet little spirit. She'll always be remembered for her work on The Mary Tyler Moore Show. I think that's one of the greatest sitcoms of all time. But she was on a lot of other shows, a 5-time Emmy nominee. She was on Everybody Loves Raymond, Hot in Cleveland, lots of appearances on other shows. We don't know the cause of death because she was a Christian Scientist, and so she didn't consult doctors. But, you know, she'll always be remembered.
So, Will, I'm going to try and pronounce it. Thank you. Kazuo Koike.
I'm sure I've screwed that up.
A legendary manga creator. Well, why don't you explain who he is?
Yeah, he died at 82, and he created Lone Wolf and Cub. He did the book, and the illustrations were by Goseki Kojima, or probably Kojima. This is a great, great manga. It's the first manga I ever read when it was reissued in the original sort of Japanese format where you read right to left, and it was the size that they did in Japan. So it was a really cool way to experience the book as close to the way people in Japan experienced it. It's a great, great manga franchise. It began in 1970. It spun off 6 movies, a film franchise, 2 TV shows, 4 plays. It's about a lone samurai, of course, disgraced and on his own, with a 3-year-old son in tow. And he's looking to avenge the betrayal by the clan that falsely accused him. So it's epic in scope. It had marvelous historical accuracy, great artwork, really captured the Bushido era, sold millions of copies, lots of spin-offs, and is hugely influential. You will hear a lot of Western artists like Frank Miller, Max Allen Collins, and Quentin Tarantino. If you like Kill Bill, trust me, he was inspired in part by the work of Kazuo Koike. So a really, really cool major artist in Japan who has died, but his work will live on.
Well, and this next person is not a name you might know, yet was incredibly important to the film industry, incredibly influential. His name is David Picker. He was a studio exec at Universal Studios, listen to me, United Artists and Paramount and Columbia. He died at the age of 87. Now, if that name is not familiar, this is the guy that optioned a little book called James Bond. He optioned all those James Bond novels.
And he made that happen. Yeah, this is a guy I thought, oh, some white studio exec, male guy, whatever. He's around a long time. I'm sure he's got a lot of movies that sort of happened on his watch, whatever. And I kind of wanted to ignore him. But when I read the bios of him, I thought, wow, this guy's got a really good career. I mean, James Bond alone, he was an exec at the United Artists, and he optioned the James Bond novels as a vehicle for director Alfred Hitchcock, and he pushed for Sean Connery as the lead. I mean, you can mic drop right there. You know, you helped make the James Bond. You can dine out on that for the rest of your life. That is amazing.
And you took over United Artists, and then you made movies like Women in Love and Midnight Cowboy. Oh, and Last Tango in Paris, yeah. and The Long Goodbye. Oh, and you signed Woody Allen to a long-term deal. Yeah, okay, again, you're doing pretty well.
Yeah, the first original film that he championed at United Artists, one where he said, you guys need to back this project, he made it happen, was a British movie called Tom Jones, which went on to become a smash hit and win the Oscar for Best Picture. He urged United Artists record label to make a documentary about the Beatles. He said, this little band looks interesting. I mean, he helped make that happen. He gave Hal Ashby his first directorial job. He went independent, later backed Hal Ashby on Bean There, his classic great last film. Well, not his last film, but one of his last films. And as an independent producer and at other studios, he was around The Jerk, The Last Emperor. He greenlit Grease and Ordinary People. He did The Crucible with Daniel Day-Lewis. And then he went into TV. He worked with Hallmark on their TV movies. You know, the Hallmark TV specials, those were so successful. Hallmark now has its own cable channel. I mean, and yes, he was involved with Ishtar because nobody's perfect. But that is amazing.
One movie. I mean, one bad movie.
That's an amazing, interesting career. And really, from the description, he seems to have really been a creative exec who was really involved in making good projects happen and showed great taste for a long, long time.
Well, somebody else who showed great taste and died at the age of 64 is producer Steve Golan. And I guess he's like a producer manager because this is a guy that started out and he, in the early 80s, he did these direct-to-video movies with a guy named Yanni Sigvatsson. And together they... Well, yeah, together they formed Propaganda Films. And let me tell you, they were without a doubt the biggest name in commercials and music videos. He helped discover Spike Jonze and David Fincher and, I mean, Simon West, Antoine Fuqua, Michael Bay. They were all
directors. So that pipeline from ads into movies, which happened elsewhere, of course, Ridley Scott and other people. But he was a big part of that.
Yeah, and then they sold a part of that to PolyGram, and then he sold the rest of it a couple years later. But he was a producer, producing movies like Wild at Heart, The Revenant. He did Mr. Robot. The TV show Being John Malkovich, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. He helped package True Detective, and
package,
he was the
head package.
Well, he was a manager. That's kind of what their job is to package things for their clients. Mm-hmm. In fact,
and you knew him, didn't you?
Yeah, well, through you know, Propaganda Films back in the '80s. I mean, if you were working in music videos, you worked with Propaganda Films or you did not work. And, you know, as when you're in production and you're a production coordinator, you inevitably wound up working, you know, for Propaganda Films.
Yeah, we got the news about his death right before we went into recording our show. So a sad news to hear right towards the end, but that's what happens. And I thought, oh, another reason. Oh, no, this looks like an important guy too. And there's obviously, yeah, there was an important theater producer, a publicist, or a theater talent manager. There's lots of people all the time. We try to just choose the people we have some personal connection to, or like, I love the Mary Tyler Moore Show. I think it's the greatest show of all time. That producer's credit, the film exec, that's an amazing career. So you knew this guy. So I mean, we can't cover everyone. And believe me, if we don't cover someone, it's not because we don't think they're not important. It's just because we think we don't have anything necessarily interesting to say about them.
But we have something interesting to say almost every week. Definitely every week that we have a show, we have something interesting to say. And you know what? If you don't want to miss some of our interesting anecdotes.
And why would you?
You want to subscribe to us in iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can find our show. You can rate and review the show in those podcast aggregators. It helps other people find the show. It helps us out when you do that. That information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode. That's also where you'll find ways to email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7. You can also follow us on Twitter at Showbiz Sandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. Again, all that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's God Bless America.
I'm sure that's taken.
I imagine it is. And we just got a headline. You think Avengers is going to be big? Pre-sales in North America are now estimated to be $120 million.
That's
the pre-sales. The pre-sales. Yeah. That's a good opening weekend. Lordy.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry at godblessamerica.com, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his coverage is aggregated. Of course, at some point, you'll be able to check out bookfilter.com again.
It's available. No, it's parked for free. Or maybe somebody owns it and they haven't done anything with it. That's bizarre. Why would you buy God Bless America and not do anything with it? Oh, well.
Waiting for the best offer.
Kate Smith's family will buy it.
Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
I'll tell you what really makes me angry is God Bless America with Kate Smith was so short. She sang it really quickly. It was like 90 seconds. You were in and out of that song right away. It's like, we don't have time. Baseball's long enough. So I'm going to miss it for that reason alone.